I'm Mark Simpson, and this is Intersection. This week, the country is reflecting on the meaning of the 10th anniversary of the September 11th terrorist attacks. As part of 90.7's look back at their impact, we'll speak with Terry Abbott about his experience that day. Abbott was the chief of staff for the U.S. Department of Education and with George W. Bush in Florida as the president received the first news of the events unfolding on 9/11. And later in the program, we'll delve into the meaning of fundamentalism 10 years after the dramatic events that changed America. That's ahead on Intersection. On the morning of 9/11 in September 2001, President George W. Bush was at an elementary school in Sarasota, Florida. He was reading a storybook with children and promoting his No Child Left Behind policy. Standing by the president's side was Terry Abbott, then chief of staff for the U.S. Department of Education. Terry joins us by phone from Fort Myers to describe the 9/11 attacks from his vantage point. Terry, good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you, too. Thanks for having me on.
So you flew down to Sarasota on Air Force One the day before 9/11. Where were you, though, when you first learned about the terrorist attacks in New York?
Well, I was in the library of the school, Emma Booker Elementary School in Sarasota, waiting for the president to come in. At the moment, he was in the classroom with the kids, and I was in the library for what was to be the big event that day, and that was his speech to the entire group of kids and to parents talking about the importance of reading and about the No Child Left Behind program, which was pending in Congress at that time. And so we were standing in there. I was there with other White House staff and when we saw the second plane hit the tower. And at that moment, of course, the entire world knew that our country was under attack, and we were in war at that very moment.
So you actually saw some footage of the second plane hitting the tower. Where did you see that?
We did. We were in the library watching the smoke building up from the first tower, and then we immediately heard the reports about the second tower being hit, and we were seeing the video that was airing as a result of the second tower hitting. That's when my BlackBerry lit up. I started getting frantic messages from the White House and from my own office in Washington telling me about it and telling me that the president was going to have to leave almost immediately and that they needed the Secretary of Education, my boss, to stay behind at the school and to work with the kids there and to finish up that event for the president. So when President Bush came out of the classroom and headed into the library to make his first remarks, he walked right past me, and Secretary Page was behind him. And so I pulled the secretary aside and said, "Sir, you've got to stay behind here and finish up this event for the president. He has to leave because of what's happened." And Secretary Page turned to me and said, "What's happened, Terry? Nobody's told me anything." And so I told the Secretary of Education about the attacks of 9/11.
We've all seen that famous footage of President Bush. He's reading the book to the children there, and then someone comes up and whispers in his ear about what has actually happened. Where were you when that moment happened?
I was in the library. That was in the classroom where the president was reading with kids, and his chief of staff, Andy Card, walked up and whispered to him that a second plane has hit the second tower. America is under attack. The president got up a few minutes later, walked into another room, got a quick briefing, and then he came into the library to address the nation. And I was in the library waiting for him to come in and address the nation and working with the White House staff to get ready to get him out of there.
What did you sense and what did you feel as you saw that event unfolding? What mood changes did you sense as an observer?
Well, you could see it on the president's face. He turned from being there about this reading program to being in one instant a wartime president. You have to keep in mind that up until that point, the biggest part of the administration was his No Child Left Behind program, education program that we were trying to get through Congress at the time. Education was going to be the centerpiece of President Bush's presidency. In that instant, he became a wartime president, and in that instant, we all started acting on instinct. We knew we were under attack, but we didn't know where, and we didn't know by how many people and who were all the targets. For all we knew, Air Force One was going to be targeted on the way back to Washington. One of the things I had to do was there's something in government called the continuity of government, and the Constitution specifies how the succession to the presidency takes place. And the law says that the Secretary of Education, like all of the cabinet members, are in line of succession to the presidency. And so what I had to do at that moment was, once President Bush left, make sure that the secretary was safe, because he might also be under attack. And so we pushed him out of there as quickly as we could, got him into a squad car, and raced away to the Sarasota airport to try to catch up with Air Force One. We got there too late. Air Force One had already left. But the biggest sense that we all had that day was, we walked into that school being the education president, and we walked out of that school being a wartime president.
It was your job and Education Secretary Rod Page's job to finish the event at the school in Sarasota. How did you wrap that up? How do you come out of the president telling these school children and the nation that they're under attack?
Good question. The secretary stepped up there and tried to reassure the children that the president and members of Congress and the rest of the administration was very rapidly moving to deal with what had just happened. You know, the secretary had all different age groups in there in that room at the time at that elementary school. So he reassured them that America was strong, that there were good people working on this, and that that our country was going to be all right. And then he went ahead with what a little bit of what had been planned that day, and that was to talk about the importance of kids working hard in their studies and how critically important reading is to the American education system. And then we wrapped it up as quickly as we could, and we tried to hurry Secretary Page out of the school, but at the same time not do it in a way that scared all those little kids to death, just like President Bush didn't immediately jump up and run out of the room when Andy Card whispered to him in his ear about what had happened. So it was a delicate balancing act, and I have to honestly tell you, I just operated on instinct that day, even though I'd been briefed on the continuity of government, the top secret briefing that we all got. That day I was operating on instinct as to what to do and how to proceed.
As you leave the school, where are you heading to and why are you going there?
Sure. When I walked out of the building with Secretary Page, I told the sheriff's deputies there from the county, I said, "This man's the Secretary of Education. We got to get him out of here." And so we shoved him into the squad car and we raced off to the Sarasota airport. What we were going to try to do was to catch up with Air Force One and go back to Washington with the president. But by the time we got to the airport, Air Force One was already gone. So Secretary Page and I were stranded at the Sarasota airport.
So the Secretary of Education, though, in that line of succession, what does he do then if he's stranded at the Sarasota airport and the country's under attack?
What we had to do was put him in as secure a facility as we could there at the airport. And then the military dispatched a military aide to be there with the secretary to, one, help to protect him, but two, to keep him informed as to what was going on, to give him the latest information. That's where we first started seeing up close what they call the fog of war. And that is when you get into those war-type situations, how a lot of that early information can be wrong. We were told that morning by the military aide. The military aide told Secretary Page that a plane had crashed on the National Mall. He told the secretary that a plane had crashed into the U.S. Capitol. And believe it or not, the military aide came to the secretary and said, I regret to inform you that the United States government has had to shoot down a passenger airplane in Pennsylvania. So the first word that the secretary got was that Flight 93 out of in Pennsylvania was shot down by us.
Which turned out to be incorrect.
All those things turned out to be incorrect. There's so many things in a war-type situation like that, those early pieces of information will very often turn out to be wrong, and that's what we were seeing. And that was the information that was being given at the highest levels to, you know, a member of the cabinet. So it was a very difficult day, and a lot of people did great work that day, not the least of which were the people who gave their lives in Washington and New York.
Terry Abbott was with President George W. Bush on September 11, 2001, as the president was at an elementary school in Sarasota, Florida. Abbott was serving as chief of staff for the U.S. Department of Education. Terry, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me in.
Coming up on Intersection, changing views of the term fundamentalist. This is 90.7. Fundamentalist. It's a word that is applied to Christians, Muslims, even politicians, but the word carries certain connotations, and 10 years after the 9/11 terrorists, were described as Islamic fundamentalists, the word remains an active part of the national conversation involving religion, politics, and international relations. Here to talk about the concept of fundamentalism and how that view has changed since 9/11 are Rollins College religion and terrorism expert Mario D'Amato. Mario, welcome.
Thank you. Hello.
Great to have you here. And also his Rollins colleague, Rachel Newcomb, who teaches and researches on the Middle East and North Africa. Rachel, good to have you with us.
Thank you.
Rollins College will be screening a documentary called The Fundamentalist this week. It explores the issue of Islam, Christianity, Judaism, and Buddhism. Mario, what is religious fundamentalism?
Well, I would say that there's two main approaches to trying to define what fundamentalism is. One would be to look at it historically. And when you look at it historically, you see that the beginnings of fundamentalism really come out of the early 20th century. In 1909, there were a group of theologians that came together under the auspices of a Protestant organization that was trying to define the precise terms of what the fundamentals of Christianity were. And they published a series of 12 volumes, 12 pamphlets, in which they sort of laid out the most important tenets of Christianity, like what they understood to be the most important principles of Christianity, which were not revisable or subject to change, the fundamentals, as it were. For example, the most important might be the inerrancy of Scripture, that Scripture is entirely correct, and that the primary reading of it should be the literal reading.
So really a modern concept in a way.
It is definitely a modern concept, something that, again, emerged at the beginning of the 20th century. Around 1909 is when these volumes started to be published. After that, however, eventually, the term came to be generalized and used by scholars of religion and social scientists and others interested in studying religion. So, for example, there was a five-volume series published out of the University of Chicago led by Martin Marty and Scott Appleby. It was volumes exploring fundamentalism. And they looked at various dimensions of fundamentalism, not just in Christianity, but in Islam and Judaism and Buddhism, Hinduism. And they came up with varying accounts of it. And the first thing to note is that the accounts that they arrived of fundamentalism were the accounts from an outside perspective, not from Christian believers themselves, for example. And the basic terms of their account are something like fundamentalism describes movements which were trying to respond to modernity, and religious movements trying to respond to modernity and the threats that these religious movements perceived from modernity, from, say, secularization.
So a reaction to, you know, as you move through the 20th century, you see that pull back, especially to modernism after the Great Wars, World War I, World War II.
Yes, exactly. And so just an increasing tendencies of secularization in culture. And so, for example, in U.S. history, you could see it with some key Supreme Court cases like 62-63, banning school prayer in public schools, or Roe v. Wade.
Well, today, do we see fundamentalism as a term, as a blanket phrase tacked on specifically just to religion?
Well, I mean, the term has also been applied to other movements. So, you know, one could speak of fundamentalism in other domains. I don't know, like perhaps like a fundamentalist in economics or something. So I've certainly seen it applied in other domains, wouldn't you say, Rachel?
Right. And I think it's also important to note that the people who would be very religious, whether they're Christians or Muslims or Jews, would object to the use of the term fundamentalist because it is such a loaded word, and people within those faiths have different. Fundamentalism was okay for Christians until the 1970s. And then when it became associated more with the Iranians in 1979 with that revolution, then the Christians themselves said, we don't want that term. We are evangelicals.
So do we see talk to me a little bit more about that. Do we see anybody reaching back into wanting to have that brand? Evangelicals still exist, but now I think you see intermixing of this phrase fundamentalism so much in so many different areas. People might combine the two, talking about evangelical fundamentalists, or you can see it as applied to Muslims as well.
Right, but I think it's very much an outsider label, and Muslims would object to the use of that term as well.
Yeah, and I would add that especially after 9/11, the term came to be associated with terrorism, with extremism. And so there are very few that I think, would self-identify as fundamentalists. So, for example, there was a survey done in 05, so a few years after 9/11, that offered a series of 13 different descriptors saying which one term describes your religious identity. And while 15.8% would say born again, and 18.6% would say Bible-believing, and 2.9% would say evangelical, only 1% of the respondents of the survey would self-describe as fundamentalist.
Well, Rachel, I want to ask you a little bit more about fundamentalism since 9/11. We hear about it more often, but does that really mean, is it on the rise, or is this just a case of greater sensitivity, greater awareness in the 9/11, post-9/11 world?
Well, I think it's a case of both. I think that the 9/11 really amped things up in terms of the U.S. trying to have a war on terror and to really seek out fundamentalism where it became a threat to us politically. But I think it's interesting if you look back at the history of Islam, there have been several so-called fundamentalist movements where people decided they needed to go back to the first generation or two after the Prophet and try to recover the origins of the faith. And that happened in the 13th century and then again in the 18th century with the founder of Wahhabism. And even Wahhabism is a term that a lot of Muslims who are, you know, what outsiders might call fundamentalists, they would object to. And then again, even the vast majority of those fundamentalist Muslims are themselves peaceful and don't believe in jihad. So it's, again, it's a very small minority of groups that aspire to the, you know, going back to the origins of the faith, but at the same time in a violent way.
And of course, yeah. Wahhabism coming out of Saudi Arabia as a very conservative sect of the Muslim faith, and of course the term jihad we've heard so much applied generally as holy war.
Right. And but again, that, you know, the Wahhabism had been around since the 18th century. It really didn't get amped up until political grievances became attached to it in the 1970s, and also petrodollars allowed the movement to really flourish throughout the world.
And sort of picking up from some of the thoughts that Rachel offered, I think it is important to kind of distinguish that it's a common tendency in religious traditions for there to be a kind of reform or revival movement to try to return to the origins, because religions tend to view themselves less as evolving, historically changing, but rather as trying to kind of get back to some sort of originary moment or revelation or back to the divine source. So it's not entirely new in the history of religion for a movement to try to kind of go back to its origins and renew its beginnings and get back to that. But when did we start to think of that as fundamentalism? And again, 1909, right, is like when that term first became a self-described term. But then further, we'd also have to look at what is the history of that particular term. And we'd have to be very sensitive to the fact that today in public perception, there's been a large movement towards viewing that term as very negative.
Mm-hmm.
So there might be a lot of people out there that see the term as of fundamentalism as a negative term.
And with connotations, negative connotations.
Exactly, with negative connotations as somehow analogous to extremism, terrorism. But
so where
there
do you
are
make,
many people
where do you make that divide? Where do you make that divide? How do you tell when something that is maybe a fundamentalist movement has crossed that line into extremism or acts of terrorism? Are we splitting fine hairs?
I wouldn't say that they're fine hairs, because there are people's beliefs and lives at stake. So I think that, you know, there's a lot at stake with how we understand these terms. But some scholars, for example, have recommended that we just dump the term fundamentalism altogether, other than for those that self-describe, which, you know, according to the survey that I cited, was 1%.
What do you think, Rachel? Is the term fundamentalism something that should be dumped in general from the lexicon of the language? Has it become too charged?
Yeah, I think it's not a very useful label at this point. And the problem with it is that, you know, a lot of people get lumped into that term who are not violent people and who would not, as you say, hurt anyone. They just are people who want to go back to the origins of their faith, but they look and, you know, sound like they might be extremist, except minus the violent ideology. So they then get fundamentalist attached to them too. So it has negative connotations.
You know, one thing that I think is so interesting, we hear that term fundamentalist in the heavy dialogue between Muslims and Christians in the post-9/11 world, but also that term could extend into Buddhism, maybe Hinduism, but I think also of atheism. And as an example that comes to my mind, Christopher Hitchens, mm-hmm. the writer for both Slate and Vanity Fair, is someone who's very strong-minded as an atheist and almost to the point of disavowing other faiths, even as he himself, in a life-and-death struggle with cancer, still a rigid atheist. Mm-hmm. And there is sometimes a vehemence in some of the language that I think comes through in someone like that. Talk to me a little bit about how this idea of fundamentalism need not necessarily be applied to someone who is searching for God or the higher being.
Yeah, I mean, I do think that there's some sense to that. And if we're to sort of understand the term or say that we're to interpret the term fundamentalist as extremist, right? But I still think we're a bit on shaky ground. And I a little bit tend towards moving away from even employing the term fundamentalism, again, other than for those very small percentage that would self-identify.
I think
what's maybe more interesting is to kind of look at these different movements and try to understand their patterns in their own terms and to try to see with clearer eyes or even with fresh eyes, like what exactly is going on.
Does that term still live, though, if you look back in your own historical chronology of the word as mm-hmm. a reaction to modernism, mm-hmm. that concept of modernism moving away from God and into a more sterilized and atheistic view? Have the atheists gone so far that they are in that label now?
To me, it seems that it would be a little bit of a stretch in my view to apply the term fundamentalist to, say, someone like Hitchens or an atheist who holds quite uncompromising views. As a scholar of religion, I don't find it terribly troubling that religious believers are uncompromising in their views. It would be somewhat odd, I think, to be fully committed to a religious faith and to say that, but I'm not really, you know, I'm not sure that I really believe this, or I think that you could convince me given 18 minutes or something. So it doesn't seem to me terribly surprising or shocking that people are committed to their beliefs, nor even troubling. But I still think that, you know, in a democratic and open society, we have to learn to be able to understand one another and speak to one another. And I don't think applying a term like fundamentalism is necessarily going to help that.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 WMFE-FM. I'm Mark Simpson. We're talking about fundamentalism in the decade after 9/11 with Rollins College professors Rachel Newcomb and Mario D'Amato. You can join the conversation at the WMFE Facebook and Twitter pages. Rachel Newcomb, you know, we look at what is going on in the Muslim faith as Americans here in the 9/11 world, that rhetoric about Muslim fundamentalists has certainly been ramped up in the years afterwards, driven on by things like the war on terror moving into Islamic countries like Iraq and Afghanistan. And I wonder, you know, having spoken to local Islamic leaders and read some about this, it seems like the Islamic faith by some scholars is being framed as going through a reformation period. Do you think, is North Africa and the Mideast in the wave of Islamic fundamentalist movement?
Well, I think that those strands always exist in that region. But I think if you look at what's been going on recently, particularly with the events of the Arab Spring, those events of people wanting to have self-determination and to have their own form of government that they have chosen, it hasn't been religious figures who've been behind that, and it hasn't been so-called fundamentalists who are driving it. And they may be significant elements that other groups have to learn to get along with and deal with, and sort of the after effects of those revolutions. But I think the fact that they haven't been central to those revolutions is really significant. I think they're not as big a deal as we think they are.
What about the fear and the concern, though, that as these Arab Spring revolts spread across those countries, that fundamentalists will move in? That's the big fear that a lot of people have.
Right. I think that is a concern, but we've also, America has been intervening in the affairs of many countries in this region for the past 40 or 50 years or so. And so in a sense that some of the people that we supported were actually antithetical to democracy or to, you know, oppress their people and were, you know, really terrible leaders. And so now I think we're kind of stepping back and letting the chips fall where they will. And actually the cooperation with Egypt and Tunisia has actually improved in recent months. And so they're not as concerned as they were initially that those countries were not going to cooperate with us once they lost their leaders who are our friends.
How do those policies, though, compare with the U.S.'s historical intervention in that region? Certainly the overthrow of the Shah in the late 1970s, a reaction to U.S. policy there, and you saw the meter swing very dramatically the other way into forming that Islamic conservative state.
Right. I don't think people were, you know, even intelligence experts hadn't predicted that coming. And but, you know, Iran is a very different case because they're Shi'i and not Sunni. So
tell us about that.
Well, it's a, you know, it's a distinction that goes back to the very early days of Islam, and it's all about succession. And the first days after the prophet died, there was a disagreement about who would succeed him. Would it be a member of his family, or would it be the right man for the job? And so the differences go all the way back to then. But they also are different doctrinal differences, too, even though they both believe in the Quran. There are the Shiites follow different they follow different spiritual leaders who lived after the prophet, and the Sunnis don't follow them at all. And so but political grievances have kind of come to bear on that as well. And, the Shia always have felt that the Sunnis were trying to attack them or overthrow them, even back to the very earliest days. So it's a tension that goes back to the earliest days.
And we see it still a driving factor in places like Iraq and around that region. Rachel, you know, what do you see, though, in terms of this post 9/11 world? Do you think that fundamentalism is necessarily something that's going to turn violent, or are Muslims themselves moving away from that concept? I know we mentioned that's kind of an outsider term, but from the inside view, what do you think is going on?
Right. I think it's more than 99% of Muslims are very peaceful, and it's a very small minority, and it's that minority that has also been angered by the presence of Western interests in the region, in the Middle East, in a military way, and that they sort of align that with religion. And you didn't, again, see that until the 1970s. Before that, you talk about Palestinian terrorists, but it was never religious fundamentalism associated with that as well. So it's been on the rise since the 1970s. But I also think if you look at the great majority of Muslims, they don't follow that kind of ideology and they're against it. It's just we don't hear about them as much in the news. They do speak out against terrorism and against jihad, but their voices are just not heard because it's not sensational.
Help me put on the macro lens here, guys. As we look at this decade since 9/11, where have we seen faith go in terms of importance, and what does that mean for these concepts of looking back fundamentally, trying to revive religions? Have we seen the pendulum swing in one way or another, and where is it at this moment in time?
Well, that's a difficult assessment to make. I think that if we focus on the positive, especially in America, there are a lot more interfaith efforts to try to understand the different religions by various peacemakers within the Muslim, Jewish, and Christian communities. And so I think it's good to kind of focus on those rather than on the negatives. That I don't know if you see people flocking to – I don't know what the statistics are about whether people are becoming more religious, or maybe Dr. D'Amato knows.
I haven't noticed in the data that I've looked at any – major increase or decrease in religious belief since 9/11.
So are we to say that there was not a much of an impact from that event?
I mean, I wouldn't say that there wasn't much of an impact, because certainly it's the sort of 9/11 is the sort of event that would have various impacts and ripples
throughout. A touchstone at many levels.
Yeah, at many different levels. My sense, though, is that there are different moments at which different thinkers, scholars think like, okay, this is going to lead to the demise of religion. It just hasn't happened. It hasn't happened since modernity. It hasn't happened in this postmodern world. It hasn't happened in this post 9/11 world. I don't think religion's going to go away. I think that there is, at least among many, many people, a sort of, you know, basic need to want to understand meaning. What is the meaning of my life? What am I doing here? How am I supposed to live my life? And so, I mean, there are various events that occur in history are going to have an impact on the exact forms that takes. But that basic need, I think, has been there and will continue to be there.
Mario D'Amato is an expert from Rollins College on religion and terrorism. Also speaking with Rachel Newcomb, Rollins College expert on the Middle East and North Africa. Guys, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Rollins College will screen the film The Fundamentalist this week. To find out more, visit WMFE.org/intersection. The conversation about what's happening in Florida continues online at the Florida Talks blog. Visit WMFE.org/intersection to find out more. There you can also sign up for our weekly podcast. Support for Intersection comes from our listeners. Amy Green is the assistant producer. I'm Mark Simpson, and thanks for listening.